This is Barry Tiger of the University of Wisconsin Oral History Project. I'm here with Deirdre Mahoney in the Armory, room 200 of the Red Gym. The date is June 6, 1990. Deirdre has recently completed her prelims in the history department and is going on to write her dissertation. And we're going to talk with her today about her experiences at the university and the experiences leading up to the university in the field of history. Deirdre, why don't you start out by telling us when and where you were born and where you went to school?
Okay, I was born in Italy because my parents happened to be there at the time. My father was in the service, but then we came when I was about three to the United States. Basically, he was in the U.S. Army, so it's kind of an interesting tied story. But I grew up mainly in West Hartford and Glastonbury, Connecticut, which is just outside Hartford, and went to public school through high school there. Then I went to St. Lawrence University in upstate New York for my undergrad education and graduated there in 1984.
Now, in terms of choosing the field of history, before we talk about your coming to UW, were there any experiences from within your family or from elementary school, high school, et cetera, that steered you in that particular direction?
Yeah, definitely. I had always been interested in social sciences and had done well, and I had probably about three high school teachers that were just excellent in history. Interestingly, I declared my major as history when I went to St. Lawrence, but changed it to poli-sci, but later decided that I really had made the wrong choice. So, but by then, you know, I had gone too far to really change it. I had taken enough other history courses while in college, but didn't really make the switch back to history. But as soon as I graduated, I realized that that wasn't a field I really wanted to pursue graduate studies in.
What was it about history as opposed to poli-sci?
Well, I think poli-sci can get very jargon-ridden, it sort of perceives itself as a science when, in fact, I don't really believe it can be, and is very ahistorical. In fact, I remember reading a book by Graham Allison, who is, I guess, teaches or is dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, and he was giving all these theories about why the Cuban Missile Crisis actually happened, and history was just totally absent from it. And I said, how could this be? How could you write a book about the Cuban Missile Crisis and not talk about the Cold War in a historical context? And I just got so frustrated with that book, and the whole, that was a culmination of a lot of problems I had been seeing in the field of political science, that was sort of a turning point, if you will, about what I was going to go to study afterwards.
I sort of asked the second question first. The first question should be, what led you to political science initially?
Right. I thought that maybe it would be more current, it was more of a cutting edge kind of a thing. At my school, actually, it was the history department was very good, but it was very small at St. Lawrence, and it just seemed maybe that I wanted. You know, I was always interested in current events and everything. I thought, well, maybe political science would be more relevant. But when I really got into the discipline itself, except for political theory and some international studies things that I was interested in, I really thought that as a discipline I much preferred history. And I took some really good history courses while I was at St. Lawrence, not even in American history, which is my particular field now, but in Japanese and history of the Holocaust also, that were really good. And I just realized that I liked history so much better and did much better in it. So,
Were the courses in Japanese history and Holocaust history, were those electives that you took?
Yeah. It was. I wouldn't even say it was a minor, but I took about four or five courses in history, and probably eight in poli-sci.
When you selected your history and I guess your poli-sci courses too, did you select them primarily on the person teaching them or the subject or a combination?
A combination. I mean, in a small university like St. Lawrence, it has 2,000 people. Basically, you hear about the reputation of a professor, and I'd say three or four of the history professors that I had taken were recommended to me highly, so I went ahead and took them. And the other one was new, but it turned out he was very good too.
How would you characterize the quality of your education in college, St. Lawrence?
I thought it was interesting because St. Lawrence seems like a party school, and it's not it's not a top school like Ivy League or even near Ivy League. It's a bit below that, and a lot of the people are sort of they're really interested in pursuing a business career, but I didn't really know that when I went there. But the nice thing about it was that it was small, so the student-faculty ratio was very small, and the number of people that were really interested in, going more than a passing grade or, a B average were very few. So, when you did take an interest, the professor was always there to, encourage you and, be supportive in your interests and really, you were singled out for your academic interest, whereas most people, they weren't really, that was not their primary interest. Their primary interest was, just getting a degree so that they could, go work for, IBM or, perhaps go on to get a law degree.
So it's pretty career-oriented.
Right. I think most, in the 80s, that's sort of the trend anyway, is more people are into their careers and more people are interested in business. It's a very growing field. But a lot of people did go on, when I read Alumni Magazine, they have MBAs and law degrees. I mean, I never, rarely read about someone going into academics. Or if they do, it's probably more like environmental or science oriented.
When I went to attended high school, we had something called Backward Day where we did everything backwards, and that's how I'm asking these questions today, unfortunately. Why did you choose St. Lawrence?
I'm not even really sure how it happened. I think just word of mouth, people had told me about it. And I knew I wanted to go to a small school. I, for some reason, thought I wanted to go to school in Boston originally, and I went to BC, which is a large campus. And when they started showing me the gym and how great the gym was, and I went and looked at all the other facilities, they didn't seem as hot. I thought, well, I don't even really play sports, so I also thought it was a little bit more like a high school. It seemed like a kind of a rah-rah school, as it were. And so I thought, well, maybe I prefer something a little smaller, more intimate. And so I was looking at more smaller schools, and so I settled on St. Lawrence. Although it could have been a number of smaller liberal arts schools in the East, but St. Lawrence I just knew from friends of my family that had gone.
Okay, now you graduate from St. Lawrence, and you have a major in political science, and the next thing I know in terms of my knowledge of your background is you're at UW majoring in history, taking your graduate program. How did that evolve?
Well, I knew when I graduated from St. Lawrence that I wanted to pursue graduate education, but I wasn't really sure. I had pretty much discounted law because I just decided that that wasn't the way to go. And I did work for like two and a half to three years in Washington. And then I was convinced that law was not the answer. And I had friends that went to law school, people that lived in my various houses and people I worked with that just said, no way, don't go. I've made the worst mistake in my life. So that pretty much cleared that decision for me.
The worst mistake in what sense?
Well, they just thought that law school was fun, but once you got out there as a junior associate or, sort of the peon level of law at a big firm in Washington, you just, shuffled a lot of papers, and it wasn't intellectually challenging as that, you might think from The Paper Chase or, even L.A. Law or something like that. That just was not the case, and they just said, a lot of people, when I said that I was going to go to graduate school in history, they were like, oh, wow, I'm really envious. Mm-hmm. These were lawyers, so I just thought, well, that says something. Mm-hmm. And I knew a lot of people that were paralegals that thought they were going to go to law school, and after being paralegals, they decided that that was not their choice. But I was thinking maybe going to the School for Advanced International Studies, which is part of Johns Hopkins, but it's located in D.C. But then I decided that that wasn't really, it wasn't an academic program, and I really was suited to an academic program, not just a, you know, it's fairly much a professional degree that you would get, a master's, so you wouldn't go on for a PhD. And so then I just said, well, history is what I've always liked, and I really don't want to pursue political science, so that's what I'll do.
Where did you apply?
Well, I applied to Columbia and Berkeley and Wisconsin.
Why?
Columbia, because I just heard that it was an excellent history program, and Berkeley as well. And Madison, I applied because two of my professors had gone there, from St. Lawrence, had gone there, and, you know, were very good, and I just had heard that it was an excellent university all around, but particularly in history.
Had you been to Wisconsin, visited Wisconsin?
No, I hadn't. I didn't visit until I was accepted.
Okay. So you were accepted at Wisconsin?
And right.
Why did you select Wisconsin?
Because I thought it would be good to go to a state university too, because you know, I needed to go to a state university for financial reasons, because it's very difficult to go elsewhere unless you're fully funded.
When did you arrive in Wisconsin?
I arrived in September or probably August of '87, and I started about a week after I
What were your initial
arrived.
Impressions of the campus and the town?
Well, I had come here earlier to find an apartment just for the weekend, and it was in May, and I went out to the terrace, and I thought, wow, this is a great place. I wasn't too impressed with the humanities building, because it was on the weekend, so I didn't go inside. I thought it was the worst piece of architecture I'd seen in a long time. But I was really impressed by, it seemed like a very livable city. People seemed relaxed. It seemed really, you know, fun place to, you know, be. And it reminded me a little bit of Burlington, Vermont, which is another college town that I was familiar with, without the skiing, of course. But so I liked it a lot, but I was, in fact, coming from D.C., very much shocked by first the green, and second of all, there were no minorities at all. And I was, you know, that did strike me.
What were you doing in
D.C.? I was working for a public interest consumer group. It was originally founded by Ralph Nader, but he was no longer associated with it directly. But I wasn't really doing any, you know, I just thought, well, maybe I'll do something, maybe not pursue political science, but maybe I'd be interested in, you know, getting involved in, you know, Washington things. I think it's kind of a normal thing for people that are interested in politics to want to do, go down to D.C. I mean, there's floods of people every year doing that. But it wasn't something that I knew that was going to be a career.
American history. Why American history? How did that interest develop?
I had just always taken a lot of courses, you know, as a high school student, and then even college, I had taken, you know, some American history, and had taken poli sci and, you know, literature, and I just thought that it would be a good thing to do that. I hadn't had enough exposure to other types of history to really develop an affinity for those.
What about your first semester here? What was that like?
Well, it was very hard work, because it was, first of all, I hadn't been out of school for 3 years, so that was definitely a change. You don't write very much. I mean, you write memos and, you know, certain things, but nothing academic. I took two 901 seminars, which are just reading seminars, and then one research seminar. And I was doing a work-study job for about 10 hours a week. No one gets a TA the first semester, in the history department at least. So basically, although I did have a social life and did meet a lot of people, you know, it was a real change, because, you know, when you're working, you have the weekends off, you have the evenings off. You might put in extra time during a project, but this was constant work, and you know, the feeling of sort of guilt when you didn't work, or leaving, you know, to even go out on the weekend for, you know, one night, you're like, oh well, it's getting, you know, really late in the semester, I have a lot of papers. I think I had around 9 or 10 papers that semester, which, you know, for one semester, your first semester, it's a lot. But generally, you know, I felt like I could handle it and that it was a good experience.
What about, well, let's, first of all, people, you know, 75 years from now are going to be listening to this tape. A reading seminar is where you essentially just do readings?
Right. Basically, most seminars require that you read a book a week. You might have to write a little praeses, which would be like a summary of the argument, the thesis, and how well the author defends that thesis. Or you just might come in prepared to discuss it. You probably have 2 or 3 papers and maybe a long paper at the end. And it's basically just a discussion seminar, usually led by the professor.
How many people approximately?
Well, it's supposed to be around 12, but because in the American department, or the American caucus, excuse me, they accepted a lot more people the year I entered than normal, so it could get upwards of 18 people.
How many did they accept?
I don't remember the exact number, but you know, our class was very large, maybe 20 or 25 in our caucus.
Of those 20 or 25, how many do you know who took prelims, or who have already, with you, or who have already passed them?
About 10 have passed, and another handful are planning on taking them in the fall.
So you lost, have you lost some?
Yeah, about 5 or 7 people. Some people never intended on going past the master's, but some people, either for financial or just, you know, interest reasons, decided not to.
Do you feel that pressure initially of being able to cut the mustard?
Definitely. I think the American caucus lets in so many people that you don't really have a real mentor system when you get in there. You have to sort of take a few seminars and decide what your interests are. Unless you're totally committed to one person, you have to sort of shop around for what your interests are and who you think you'd like to work with. In the other caucuses, the European and the Third World Caucus, it's more of a mentor system in that one professor will bring you in to work with them, and you'll, barring any unforeseen circumstances, you'll stay with that one professor as your major advisor. That doesn't really happen in the American caucus. A few people, you know of one professor that they really come to work with, but really most people don't. They just come and decide a year or so later when they're working with that professor on their thesis.
Do they decide, or does the professor decide, or do they decide together?
Well, I think it's mainly the student's initiative.
How did you choose yours?
Well, basically, I had wanted to do immigration even before I came here. That sort of broadened so that I was interested also in labor, too, because obviously there was a lot of overlap in the late 19th century, especially. So my professor was the person that was doing immigration history, and I took a seminar from him the first semester, so that was pretty much set. But then, you know, my other people that I see myself as working with, in addition to my major advisor, I just took because, you know, I was interested in the subject and, you know, we got along, or it was a combination of personal and academic interest, or compatibility, I'd say.
Getting ahead of myself a little bit again here. Do you have any comments on the system that was employed, or kind of wasn't employed for the American caucus early on, as opposed to the European caucus? Do you think it's something that benefits graduate students, or are there ways you could suggest improvements?
I think they admit far too many people. First of all, for the funding reason, they usually only give out a few fellowships every year for incoming students. And then, really, the second year, there are very few, you know, departmental or even graduate school fellowships. You really have to wait normally till after your prelims or even at the late dissertation stage, and you're expected to TA, which is, you know, a lot of work. There are PA ships and RA ships and various things, but for the American program, aside for a few fellowships your first year, there really isn't very much in the way of, you know, free and clear funding till after, you know, until you're well into your dissertation. So I think if they limited the number of people that they accepted, they could do a better job of funding people. And they do, I think they do set it up in a social Darwinian system of, you know, you're expected to survive, you're expected to put this, you know, ahead of everything, which, you know, it's important and everything, but I think it breeds competition that that wouldn't otherwise exist, except for there's just so many people competing for limited funds and a certain amount, number of professors, and basically getting recognition. You know, it's the onus is very much on the student to make his or her way through the program.
I went through the history program myself, so I understand that competition. How about grades? Was there how did professors handle that generally?
Well, the first thing is that grades are important, not intrinsically, but for funding. So it's always in the back of your mind that you should have to do well here, because first of all, even getting a TA ship to get on the rank list, which is basically not a secondary list, the primary list, you have to do quite well your first and second year. After your prelims, it becomes less important because you've gone through enough steps and you're, you know, further along in the program that it, your GPA no longer matters. But for all other types of funding, and including outside funding, it's very important. So, I mean, the grading system is not akin to the undergraduate grading system. It's really A's if the professor thinks you've done a good job. AB if he or she feels that it's not, you know, top quality. And B is sort of a real slight. I mean, you just don't want to get a B because it's sort of, if you get too many Bs, you're really probably not going to be successful. It's almost like, I see it as more of a message that, you know, you should be thinking about whether you're really going to be able to cut this program. Whereas AB, you know, if you get a few of those, that's fine, but you probably don't want to load up on them, or else you'll never get funding. So it is, you know, not intrinsically important, but it is because of financial reasons and because, you know, it is so hard to get through this program financially without getting some kind of aid, especially TA ships.
Pushing the social Darwinism theory just a step further, let's say you come from a particular, you, Deirdre, comes from a family of unlimited wealth and money is no problem, and you don't have to worry about getting a TA ship, or you don't even want one.
Right.
You take cut into your drinking time or whatever.
Right.
What other steps, in what other ways does the department, besides giving the kiss of death bees, in what other ways, are there points in your career where they just cut people out, where they separate them? Or?
Yes, I think it's changed a little bit. I'm under a new system, under the American program, that the year that I was, I started was the first year of this. And before that, they used to give you a letter after your first year and say, we recommend highly that you go on, you know, continue the program. We are allowing you to continue the program, or we will not allow you to continue the program. And I think that was basically a result of the grades you got, and maybe if you had done not as well as some professors thought you were capable of, maybe they would allow you to go on despite your grades. But generally, it was more based on just your grades. But not ever, because it's always a personality thing, so it's never totally objective. But now you have your master's thesis requirement that we all have to write theses, and that was not the case for the majority of people. So that's more of a concrete thing to base their judgment on. So I think because people are doing their thesis, it requires a lot more work. They don't tend to cut people off at that point as much as perhaps they did before theses were required. Prelims, most people end up passing them, but there are always, I'd say, every other year it seems, one person fails out of maybe 12 taking.
Now, if you fail, or let's say you pass, back in the old days, as I recall, you could pass but not be permitted to go on. It would sort of be a terminal, you know, point in your career.
At the prelim level?
Yeah.
Never heard of that. I think it's the
prelims. So when you go on the prelims, you're right. Pretty much assured unless you're right. One of those who doesn't make it.
Right. And the thing is, though, that I think nominally they're allowed to look at your whole record, and if you pass but got all Bs, say, then they might not let you on. But I've never heard of that happening, so I think it's just whether you pass or not. And there was a rumor that, you know, you could not pass the prelims and still be admitted, but that never happens either. It's really whether you pass the prelims or not is whether you're allowed to go on. And people have retaken them successfully, but it's up to the committee to decide, or I don't know, either the committee or the faculty as a whole, to decide whether or not to let you.
So the attrition really occurs just sort of naturally. People who lose interest, maybe move away, get married, whatever the reasons are. They occur when you get enough Bs that you get the message that you're not going to be continue on. When your thesis is not accepted for
Right, although I've never heard of that happening, but it's the first year, really, so it might happen, but I doubt it would.
So there isn't, what I'm trying to get at, there isn't any real thing anymore, like in the old days where they just said no.
Right.
It's sort of an attrition type thing.
Except for prelims.
But
very few people actually end up
few.
In the American caucus, I have to emphasize, because I can't really speak to the other ones. And this, all of this that I'm talking about for the attrition is really only for the American caucus.
That's interesting. I didn't realize how close to change.
But I still think that a lot of it is financial. I mean, even though you can say it's natural attrition, the fact that you really, you know, have to take out probably, you know, $12,000 loans if you're not otherwise funded certainly would have a bearing on whether you wish to continue, even if you are talented. And a few people do transfer every year, often because of funding, but also because maybe they've done well and they want to reapply to, you know, another school that maybe didn't accept them or...
Okay, changing the subject, you mentioned that your interest is immigration. Let's talk a little bit about that, how it developed and how you developed it. I suspect you wrote your thesis on immigration. Let's talk about your intellectual development in that area and people who might have influenced you along the way or helped you.
Well, I guess indirectly it's because my parents are Irish, and so that's always been in the back of my mind, the whole idea that they came under very different circumstances they came in late 1950s, early 60s, and they came Pan Am, not over on the boat type thing, and they were professional. So, I mean, it's a very limited experience, but the experience of, you know, just assimilation, acculturation, what aspects of someone's culture you bring over and what you really are just taking American values through education has always really interested me. And I guess I've just done a lot of reading about that, and I've always been sort of drawn to that aspect of American history as long as I can remember. So I can't think of one example where that came, but I'm sure it has something to do with my family background that I've done. But right now, I don't do late 20th century immigration. I'm very much interested, not even Irish immigration, but I'm more interested in late 19th century, early 20th century immigration, you know, unskilled workers. So it's not just a reflection of, and I'm always worried a little bit about being what they call filio-pietistic about it, and that sort of writing, it's sort of like genealogy or, you know, retracing your own family, being interested in something because of your own family. Well, you know, I try to be as objective as possible about it. I'm not really even, you know, talking about Irish people exclusively, and I wouldn't do that, but I'm just interested in the immigration experience in general. And that's where I got it from, I'd say, my family background.
What about, did you ever read Oscar Hamlin's The Uprooted?
Yeah, I did, actually.
One of my early introductions to immigration when I was a student.
Right. I think, interestingly, in the 70s and 80s, a lot of the new social historians, while saying that it was the first person to write about immigration history, he saw immigrants as very... well, as sort of dysfunctional socially, because they had like been uprooted. They had left behind their family, left behind their belongings, their identity, and come into this sort of very alien, urban, unfriendly new city in America. And what a lot of these new social historians, you know, following Herbert Gutman and, you know, history from the bottom up, who really looks at workers instead of, you know, the politicians, look at laborers instead of people owning businesses. They say that no, actually people came over in groups and they resettled in groups and they developed their own ethnic neighborhoods and they had a whole social welfare system through, you know, clubs, community organizations, bars and churches, and that they helped each other get jobs in the factory, and, you know, they helped pitch in when someone died, if the widow couldn't afford to buy the coffin or the whatever. And so that there was a whole system of networks that was very much in evidence, and that it wasn't this, you know, abrupt transition from the old world to the new world, but that there were a lot of continuities and that there was a lot of cultural retention of practices that had, and even economic practices that had occurred, and that, so it was more of a give and take.
Mm-hmm. What books, what studies, how have you been influenced in your theories and your books and views on immigration? And how has this developed in your thesis?
Okay, well, my advisor is a very interested in immigration, and he has other colonial interests and things like that, but he's also very interested in quantitative history, which is a lot of historians stay very clear of, and I probably would have maybe under different circumstances, but I decided that I wanted to do a case study of a town in Connecticut that I had some familiarity with, but the reason I chose it is because it had a large brass factory, and there were records available. And so I decided to do a census survey using quantification as my methodology. So that is an avenue that I never really thought of before I came to graduate school. And a lot of people look at me and say, you know, why would you want to do that? That sounds so boring. But it really isn't, and you can get a lot of information out of the census. It's not a perfect tool, and I never meant, or I don't think most quantitative historians want to replace the old, you know, looking through manuscripts, looking through writings, using oral history, but I think it can be supplemented really well. So what I did was I did a comparative study of various immigrant groups in Waterbury, Connecticut, and talked about the family economy, which means bringing in women, not just seeing what's going on in the factory, but how people make ends meet. And a lot of a large part of that is what women do, both inside the factory when they're unmarried or living in their parents' home, but also outside of that factory by taking, you know, out work or, you know, sewing in and getting paid for it on a, like, piece rate basis. Also taking in boarders, and, you know, women were primarily responsible for doing this and, you know, cleaning and cooking for the boarders. So I think it's a really interesting way that I've, you know, used quantitative history in a way that is not deadly dull and boring, you know. So that's something that I might use in the future in my dissertation, but I have some skills. I'm not at all an expert in it, but I feel like I'm competent at some level, and that if I want to go on, I can probably understand enough to go on with it.
Okay, we'll continue on your PhD at near the end when we get through with your prelims, but let's get back for a moment to you and your coursework now. You weren't eligible for financial aid your first year, yet I know that you did pick up a TA ship. Tell me how your financial aid evolved over the course of the next semesters.
Well, basically, financial aid is different than fellowships. Financial aid is really loans. That's in work study. So the first year, I didn't get funded my first year. So I took out, my tuition and enough to live on, and then I worked. So I basically took out lots of loans my first year. My second year, it was unlikely that I would TA, but because of circumstances, there were enough TA ships to go around. So I did TA then too, and I've TA'd my third year also, but I didn't TA when I was taking prelims, because basically you have 100 students, you have to go, you teach 5 sections and go to all the lectures and grade, and I just thought that would be a lot of pressure and a lot of work to do while I'm taking prelims, and I couldn't be sure that it wouldn't coincide with when things were getting really heavy with prelims. So I decided, I did get a small fellowship from the graduate school, which gave me in-state tuition, but I still, you know, wasn't enough to live on, but it did help enormously. But I'm planning basically from now on in to TA, and then when I have to go away, hopefully I'll be able to get funding from an outside source. There are certain, you know, semester-long or year-long funding, or you can patch together a bunch of small fellowships to allow you to go out into, you know, libraries, or if you have to go to Washington, D.C., because obviously you can't do that and TA at the same time.
Now, back when I was a graduate student and afterwards, there was a lot of the TAA, the strikes and the actions with the union were very much in the headlines. What are the concerns of graduate students in the TA Teaching Association today?
Well, there are a lot of concerns, and one of them is the teaching load is very high. We have to teach 100 students, and, you know, that's 5 sections normally a week in the history department. That's average. Very few people do less than that, and very few people do more. That means that you have to probably do, depends, but a midterm and a final, and you have to you have to read a paper usually, and you have to teach 5 different sections per week, go to all the lectures, and do all the reading so that you're on top of things and prepare. And you also have to consult with the students, because they'll generally come to you. They sometimes go to the professor, but usually they come to you because you're the one that is grading. So if they have a problem with their midterm, they'll come to you. So the teaching load and the fact that there are probably 21 students in each class, that's a lot. And Chancellor Shalala has, you know, always emphasized that she really wants to improve the quality of the undergraduate experience. And yet, you know, when TAs are forced to have such large teaching loads, you know, her word seems somewhat, you know.
Did she address this at all with you, with the union?
With TAA? I believe she has, but she, you know, she sort of sidesteps it, you know. She's not seen, you know, I think people seeing her come in and talking about the fact that women, you know, talking, you know, basically saying that women, you know, she's going to accommodate women and try to, you know, make it easier for women in academics and, you know, have, you know, this thing with if you're married to a professor, try to find two jobs since there are more academic couples now than there were before. But she really hasn't lived up to those promises entirely. There was a new contract just last month that was voted on that allowed for a 10% pay increase, which is really excellent. So I was really amazed that we were able to bargain with that. I had nothing to do with it outside of being a member, but I was pleased with that because the cost of living has gone up quite a bit and tuition's gone up quite a bit, but the TA salaries have not. Moreover, one of the best benefits of being a TA, besides if you're in-state tuition, if you're out-of-state, you receive in-state tuition, so it's not just the wages, but you also get in-state, is health care. You get excellent health care. They wanted to roll that back last year, and the TAA was able to save that so that, you know, TAs could continue to get excellent benefits.
Do you think the TAA is working for your benefit then?
Yeah.
You don't have any problems with it as an organization?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far. Sometimes I wouldn't think, you know, I don't unilaterally agree with all their decisions or, you know, or maybe their priorities. I think maybe they take on too much at one time and it's hard. But no, I'm glad that I belong, and I think that, you know, I don't think that we would get what we have right now without a TAA or some kind of a organization. The only problem is that it's not always widespread, and some departments in particular are very hostile to the TAA. History is not one of them, but I will say that mainly sciences. It's very difficult to get people to join, and yet they benefit from certain things. So generally, I'm pretty happy.
Do you have to join?
No, you don't. Now, there's a maintenance of membership agreement now that just went in, which means that people who are not joining will have to pay a portion of that, since the TAA represents them in bargaining and, you know, bargains for things like healthcare, which they benefit from, pay raises. You know, it's sort of lobbying on their behalf, mm-hmm. and yet they don't have to pay anything. So the TAA won the right to get this maintenance of membership clause, so that they will have to pay, I don't know what percentage, you know, maybe 30%. I have no idea, so don't hold me to that. But, you know, a percentage of what a member would pay.
Let me turn this table.
Yeah, I think the main point that I want to make is the financial thing that I think has changed a lot, you know.
Can you make it right now?
Okay. Oh, right,
yeah,
now?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I guess one point that I think is really different in the late 80s and early 90s from when a lot of people who are now professors in the early 60s and through the 60s is that the state of the financial situation for graduate students, it's a lot more difficult because Reagan-era cutbacks especially, there just aren't funding. I think most of my professors, a lot of them went to Ivy League schools, and, you know, so it was a little bit different, and they have obviously more money. But I think on the whole, most people were fully funded, and they didn't have to work. You know, I know people that work at the union, you know, flipping burgers, you know, on the side, you know, we have to work summers, and, you know, we also have to, mainly loans, but also working, because you're never going to make enough to cover tuition at $4.25 an hour or whatever they're paying there. So it's really different that there are a lot of pressures. And also I think with women moving in, you know, there's not usually or not always going to be the woman who's married to an academic helping him through school. Mm-hmm. She's more likely going to be in school herself. So I think there's a real difference in the way we have to finance our education compared to the 60s when, you know, there was more money, there was, you know, the Democratic administrations were, you know, looking at education as a really important mm-hmm. issue. And I don't think in the Reagan, and it's kind of too early for the Bush, but I doubt that he will be putting a lot of money into education, either undergrad or grad. And that, I think, has a real bearing on the type of people that even come to undergrad now. You know, they tend to be from families that can afford it. And generally, I was pretty lucky growing up that my parents could, you know, I did have some loans as an undergrad, but mainly they were able to help me out a lot. But, you know, there's no way, barring having a huge trust fund, that you can put yourself through 7 or 8 years of graduate school. And I think like the New York Times was wondering in an article why it took humanities scholars so long to get their PhDs, and now it takes, you know, maybe average of 8 years, whereas in the 60s it only took maybe 6 years. And, you know, I think the answer is quite obvious. And I don't think this applies at all to the sciences, because they're much better funded because of the link to science and industry and basically, you know, research funding from, say, NIH or other government funds that hasn't been rolled back in the way that aid to humanities has.
So you don't buy the education President Bush?
No, not at all.
I mean, a little facetious there. You mentioned just a moment ago about the changing role of women in society and the graduate programs. Let's talk for a moment about that. I can see the shift even from the time I went to graduate school, although there were many women attending at that point too. It seems to be really increasing. What has the university done to accommodate this change, do you think, how do you see the movement going at this point?
Well, I'm not sure if it's been conscious at all. I think one thing that there is about the history department is in the American Caucus there is a women's history program. And that was started by Professor Gerda Lerner, and there's another professor, she's just retired, but there's another professor that's been there for several years, I don't know how long. And that's been pretty active for almost a decade now. And she's been really good at recruiting people and getting funds for women in the Women's History Program. Now there's a movement among people entering the American Caucus of the History Department to not really be in the Women's History Program, but to be in the, you know, just American history in general. And this was pretty rare until my year. For some reason, there was a flood, and I'd say about half the people in the program now coming in are women, aside from the Women's History Program. But I think that's more changing education in general. Maybe as undergrads or high school students, we were encouraged to do history. Although I remember in my undergrad college, there was one or two women in history as professors and virtually no women students, as far undergrad students, as far as I can even remember. So it's still very much, if you look at who has been hired until the last 4 years, it's predominantly male as far as professors go. But they're really, in the past 3 years, I've seen a an enormous change. They're really, you know, pushing to hire more women, not only in women's history, but in the American caucus in general, and in European now, third world caucus as well.
Has the chancellor done anything to influence the direction of women's studies or women in general on this campus?
I think
other than there the was symbolic
right. I think there was more hope that she would, but I haven't seen really any concrete things, such as like daycare, or I think she was.
We're talking about Chancellor Donish.
Right, right. You know, she hasn't really. She was pushing for academic couples to sort of try and find a good position for the spouse, be that a woman or a man, because more people are academic couples, and it's very difficult to get two academic positions in one university, especially since, you know, if you are in New York or Boston or California, you could go to another university, but here in Madison, there really aren't too many other places where you could work within commuting distance if you're a professor. But I don't think she's really done a lot to do that, to help that situation. I know that one professor, a woman in our department, had a spouse that that wanted to work in the university, and she was promised that they would find a position, but it took a long time, and she had a interview in several universities and was getting a job offer, but she really wanted to stay, but finally they finagled a way to get her husband a position, but it wasn't an easy task, and it sort of demonstrated to me that, you know, Chancellor Shalala doesn't seem to be that committed to it. But I think, you know, just having a woman chancellor is a good thing, at least to show, you know, upper reaches of the administration. Women are at least getting some type of a foothold, although it is not, you know, widespread yet.
I read an interesting article in the Times several weeks ago, and I can't remember who wrote it right now, and I can't even remember the entire argument, but what it said is that in essence, and this is, I'm going to be the devil's advocate for a moment here, it said that many women's studies departments, or women's studies departments, maybe that's what it said, are by nature sexist in their organization, and that they work toward dividing the sexes rather than trying to understand people as people, and that they were set up initially to try to show that women indeed had a role in the world, history of the world as everyone else, but now they've come to become sort of an entity unto themselves. Is any of that even any valid, or do you care to comment on it?
Well, I think eventually.
I might not even have the argument right. So, but that's right. Essentially what I remember.
Well, I think eventually what people need to do is integrate gender studies or gender, looking at things in a gendered way into mainstream history. I think right now that it's still at the point where women are doing it and not always incorporating it. And so men, either students, graduate students or professors, or even undergrads, really are not getting, you know, when they teach, say, women's history as an undergrad, the most people taking it are going to be women, and so really we haven't seen it being totally incorporated into the curriculum at the undergraduate level, say. I think people are working towards that, but I still think that it needs to be done, and you know there are reasons for that, because you know it's still a fairly new field and it still has to be defined first, but I see it as it has to, you know, come in more into the mainstream so that people are really learning about it. I don't think that's happened. I don't think really male professors are doing a lot of that. Some, you know, they're open to it. And in the graduate level, you know, they're very much open. If you're going to write a paper, if you talk about women and you're doing it for a male professor, generally they're very open to it. At least, you know, they wouldn't admit that if they didn't like it, they wouldn't admit it. But, you know, so there's not an overt sexism going on there. But I do think, in a way, that there is a problem in that people assume that if you're a woman doing American history, that you're doing gender primarily. I always feel like I should incorporate women into all my work, and I do that, you know, all my papers, you know, not all of them, maybe political, you know, talking about a political administration, I wouldn't use gender analysis, but generally I do, like my thesis and my dissertation will incorporate that, but I think that you can get boxed into that where it's assumed, just like in the 50s, that if you were in a university and you were a professor and you were a woman, that you were doing home economics or English or French. I think you can get boxed into that. I mean, I think there should be women doing other things as well as women, and I have no problem. I think it's good that women are doing women's history, but I don't think, you know, I think that they should be accepted for doing political history. So still those barriers for political history or economic history or history of technology or, you know, military history, traditionally male-oriented fields, still haven't been desegregated.
So in a sense, the goal of women's studies is to eliminate the need for women's studies.
I'm not even sure if that's true. It's hard to say. I think that's my opinion. Mm-hmm. See, and I don't really know. I mean, I think it would be, yeah, generally the goal, but in a long-term goal. But I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, that's what I meant, sort of.
But see, there's so many different people doing women's history that some people would say that there's no way it should be, because we don't want it to be mainstream. We want it to be radical, you know. So there's no way to say that everyone in women's history thinks
right,
you know.
Right.
So I couldn't even really talk about what other people think. That, but I think that it should be being incorporated into the curriculum, and that it still hasn't seeped in as much because, and it, that's a factor of age too. I mean, the professors are still, most of them are older than the women's history programs around the country, and they really haven't been educated, although a lot of the women's historians have been. One person received, or one people received a large grant to incorporate women, and they're really trying to get the male professors involved in that so that they'll incorporate it into their lecture material and assign books by women and things like that. So I think, you know, there's still a long way, but I think there's also a danger in assigning women just women's history as their only option. I think that we still need to be incorporated into more traditionally male. I personally am not interested in like, say, political history, but there aren't that many women doing foreign policy, you know, or things like that.
Unless you want to study presidents' wives or something.
Right. And, you know, I still think that women, should have an interest. There's no reason that they shouldn't have an interest in that. I don't think they should not do that because women aren't making foreign policy. I still think that needs to be done.
Well, they would bring in a different perspective, perhaps.
Right.
Yeah, I see a fundamental contradiction from my own perspective. It'll be interesting to see how it resolves, because I see, on the one hand, incorporating these goals into the curriculum and getting people in there. But on the other hand, I see the bureaucratization, the possible bureaucratization of women's studies itself. And I know what happens when something gets ingrained. It's hard to shake it loose, and it's going to be interesting to see how those two ride out the storm together. And you historians who are listening to this in 75 years can listen to this probably discussion taking place in the rather early stages of this entire thing, and can use our arguments and compare them to the way things are. Boy, I'm just talking. Hold on a second. We're back again. Let's talk for a moment. We have an interesting climate on campus, interesting and also dangerous in many ways. When Chancellor Shalala took over, she instituted the Madison Plan because she was she wanted to bring more blacks on campus. When you started your interview, you said, early in your interview, you said how struck you were when you came here after being in Washington, D.C. by the relatively few number of minorities on campus. How is the history department, what are they doing that you know to try to change that picture?
Well, I don't really know because in my classes as a TA, my undergraduate classes, I've had 200 students now, and I'd say about 3 out of those 200 have been minorities. That I, you know, obviously I can't always tell the background of people, but you know, obviously minorities. And so, you know, that's kind of disturbing in itself that here we are under the Madison Plan and things really haven't changed that much. Among graduate students, there are a handful of minorities, but not very many at all. I think, first of all, the recruitment problem might be responsible in that Harvard and Yale and Berkeley and other excellent history programs are also recruiting, and they usually have a lot more money to give to people. So we generally don't give that much money to any students, and even if we were to improve on that, we still probably couldn't give enough to compete with Yale, who really wants, you know, a top-notch black up-and-coming scholar, right? So it is a real problem. So part of it might be the pool, but a lot of it is the lack of financial resources that we have. And I think maybe Wisconsin and the history department have to go out more and sell themselves. Also, really, there aren't that many minority professors in the American caucus, at least. There is an Afro-American program that is not connected directly with the history program, but does it have Afro-American history classes, but doesn't have a very big graduate program either. So somebody who was interested in history and African-American history might go for that program rather than the American history, the straight American history, you know, program. But it's hard to say because even if a plan to recruit minorities occurred, it would take a couple of years for the word to get out, for people to apply. So it's still maybe, the jury might still be out on that one.
Is there a black caucus or anything in the history department?
No, not at all.
You talked about how certainly women, female students are exposed to the women's studies courses on campus when they come here. And you've gone through your coursework now. What kind of emphasis have you had on blacks and minorities in your courses?
Well, there's a real definite movement toward including them into scholarship so that, say, for Civil War and Reconstruction, you would read somewhat, I mean, it generally wouldn't include a lot about, say, slave life, but it would include one or two books on that. So even in sort of traditional topics, non-social history topics, there is a movement towards including scholarship on minorities. And a lot of people, students, even though they might not be minorities, there is a definite leaning in the 80s and early 90s towards topics that would involve minorities. But they would mainly be white people doing those topics.
We've had some nasty incidents of perceived incidents of alleged racism on campus. Are you personally aware of any discrimination? Have you had students talk to you about about that kind of thing? Have you witnessed any of it?
Not personally, but I mean, that again is a factor of the fact that there were very few minorities in either the graduate program or among my students that I've had so far.
Okay. Moving toward away from off campus for a couple minutes before we get into where you are now in your studies, talk about the housing situation from a graduate student coming here from Washington, D.C. to Madison. How did you go about finding your first house? What has your housing situation been since you arrived here in Madison?
Well, I've been pretty happy with it. First of all, I went to the Campus Assistance Center, which is on Lake Street, and they have a printout of all available housing. And so I got an apartment. I didn't really want to live with anyone, although I generally live in my group houses or with more than one or two up to like four other roommates, or well, housemates. I decided I want to live by myself for the first year to get my bearings, and I didn't really want to move into with people that I didn't know, since I was studying, and if they were disruptive or had different lifestyle than I did, it would be distracting. So I got an efficiency apartment on North Pinckney for the first year. Then by then I had met more people, and another friend of mine who's in the history department and I decided we'd look for a place, a two-bedroom. So we got one right near Monona on West Wilson. So that was fairly inexpensive. It was a lot more inexpensive to live with one other person or even more in a house. So it really depends on your living. Well, like if you're married, you might live in Eagle Heights or in a one-bedroom apartment. But a lot of people I know do live either in efficiencies, one bedrooms, or with a lot of people.
So you didn't have any of the slum landlord problems?
My landlords have been pretty good, actually, but I live in an area that's mainly undergrad, and I can really see some rundown houses. Mine is not terribly chic or nice, but it's you know, we've done it pretty well with like buying futons and you know, keeping it nice. But it's not in the nicest area in terms of, it is sort of a student slum area.
Okay, now we're up to the present. You passed your prelims. You're going to start working on your PhD now, and you're going to be TAing next semester?
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to be writing your dissertation on?
Some aspect of immigration, but that's exactly what I'm doing right now, is narrowing my topic, because I have some ideas, but I really wouldn't want to put them on the record until I figured out which one.
What about your professor? Who are you working with on this?
Professor Archdeacon. And I'll probably, I'm assuming I will retain my committee, my prelim committee for my dissertation topic, although I think you have to have an extra person. But that's my plan, because I'm pretty comfortable with these people and they like my work, and so I feel like I do have even more than one person that I can turn to for advice along the dissertation.
How long is this going to take?
Well, I still have my minor, which for me, I think, I don't know, I think it's a somewhat superfluous requirement, in that you have to take four courses of additional work outside of the department, and so that slows you down for over a semester, and you have to pay tuition. You know, when you become a dissertator, you get a really large reduction in your tuition, but until then you have to pay a large amount. So another semester and a half of work is really slowing me down. So I hope to get it done next spring, and have started work on my dissertation by then. But since I'm TAing and taking several courses, you know, it's not going to go on that quickly.
So if it goes real well, how many years of schooling are we talking about? If everything goes well, pretty much according to plan.
You know, I would aim for an additional year of coursework and two more years to research and write my dissertation.
So 6 years total?
Right, but that is a fairly optimistic assessment, since after that I was still probably TAing, and it still requires a good amount of time out of your semester, so probably 7 is more like it, but I know other people that have 8 is not uncommon, let's say.
That's amazing. That's a long period of time.
Yeah.
Back when I got my degree in the mid-70s, the job market was about as dry as I think it ever has been. What is the job market now for history students, and how is that? How do you see it 2 or 3 years down the line? Will it be about the same?
I think it's really changing, and I think, first of all, fewer people are going into academics right now because of the 7 or 8 year commitment that it entails, and the fact that it's not a very lucrative position. If I were to apply to the history department at a major state university such as Wisconsin, I'd probably be looking at getting $30,000 or $32,000 as a junior faculty, and you know, with the loans that you would have taken out, assuming you didn't, you know, get a lot of fellowship, you know, that's a lot of money, and not very high salary. It goes up, but still, I mean, a comparable, you know, a lawyer obviously is going to start out making 50 at a, you know, a firm. So, I mean, and they only have a 3-year commitment with a similar debt load. So it's not a very lucrative thing. So a lot of people, I mean, you really have to be committed and really have to want to do it. It's not something you go into lightly and decide later that that's not something you want to do with the rest of your life. So fewer people are going into it. Moreover, the nature of education is changing in that, well, a lot of people that got their degrees in the early 60s are going to be retiring in the next 5 or 6 years. And I've read New York Times articles that say that there is going to be a shortage of faculty by the mid-90s, which is heartening to hear for me. Also, more people are returning to school for education, so older adults. So it's less of just 18 to 22-year-old undergrads, but also older adults. So there's going to be a need for more faculty. So I'm pretty optimistic. You know, the timing was just circumstance, but I'm really glad that by the time I've been out of school for a couple of years, that the market will be really moving.
What about gender? Is that going to work for you or against you, or don't you think it'll matter?
It's hard to say whether, I think now it works for you, right now, but I don't know how long that will last. And second of all, I think it would help you if you are doing gender studies, because that's a very hot topic right now. But if you're not doing primarily that, then it might not help you, and it might conceivably hurt you, because you know, if you were going to a kind of conservative school and there's still mainly men, they might not, you know, be as open to hiring women. So it really depends on the circumstances. It's not any guarantee. I'm not waiting for a guarantee that, you know, being female is going to help me get a job right now, because it's not at all clear whether it would.
Where do you want to teach? What kind of school do you want to teach in?
Well, I think I definitely like to teach at a smaller school, probably not a research university like the University of Wisconsin. It's a great place to go to graduate school, but as a professor, it will be very rigorous and demanding, and you know, fairly difficult to get tenure. I think my lifestyle would be more suited to having a lot more contact with students. I mean, I would still want to publish and do research and go, you know, on research trips and keep up with scholarship. I think that's really important, but I think I'd rather have a smaller classroom and maybe not be so removed from undergrads.
So something like St. Lawrence?
Maybe a little more connected to urban center, because that's very out, but probably on the East Coast, since that's where my family is.
I think that was about the last question. Do you have any comments you'd like to make on anything that I've missed?
No, I think we pretty much covered things.
Okay.
Erase the rest of it. great. Okay, that's. I always look at these when I do them, like yours and Amy's and the others like this, as I try to think of myself as a playwright or as a historian 75 years down the line. And that's why I really like to go into kind of minute detail sometimes on different things, because it's people who are listening to this aren't going to know. Otherwise,
yeah.
You know, there's just no way.
Well, I don't think I just. Anything